Hey, everybody, it's Andy. Welcome back to the North Point Community Church podcast. Hey, at the end of this episode, please take a moment to subscribe to our YouTube channel and download our free North Point app where you can access all of our recent message content. And actually, the app is the easiest way to share all this content with a friend, and it's the easiest way to keep up with everything going on around here at North Point. But most importantly, I hope the following presentation inspires you to take your next step in your faith journey. Enjoy.
Well, good morning. Thank you. My name is Justin. I've been on staff for a while now, just over 7 years, actually, which is crazy to me, and I've loved every minute of it. And I just want to tell you before I start, kind of something about being here, what makes me so excited. Every morning on Sundays that I get here about 5 a.m., I walk in that door over there, and I look in this room at all of the many empty seats in the room, and it just kind of blows me away and humbles me every single time. Here's why. I come from a one-stoplight town of about 1,800 people, all of which would fit in this room. And I think about back through my life and all of the decisions that I've made, dumb decisions, good decisions, all of that. And I think about where God has led me and how faithful God has been to allow me to be a part of a church like this, to even be on staff, let alone the grace that he's given me to be able to stand up here and share with you today. So I just want to express my gratitude to you for trusting me with this opportunity, because it has been truly an incredible experience ever since I've been on staff here, and a big part because of the people in this room. So thank you initially for that. Now, let's go back and talk about that one stoplight town, okay? So I grew up in Ohio, which is not close to here. Very cold, very corny, like that joke. Anyway, I grew up in Ohio, and there's not a lot to do. And so my mom decided it would be a good idea to homeschool me and my four brothers and sisters. And a lot of people ask me whenever I tell them that, hey, Justin, what's it like to be homeschooled? Here's what I tell them. Imagine you're drowning, and then your mom hands you a textbook. That's homeschooling, okay? But, you know, there were pros and cons to homeschooling, like there is everything. So pro, even though I was a skinny guy back then, I was still captain of the football team. Con, somehow mowing the lawn always made practice. Pro, I was homecoming king every year. Con, pretty hard to find a date. Pro, the lunch menu is way better when you're homeschooled. Con, I just watched the lunch lady change my brother's poopy diaper. You can go ahead and keep that egg salad, Mom. But anyway, class is hard enough to navigate in school with strangers. It's extremely hard to navigate while navigating your family dynamic. For example, I have a sister who used to be, not so much anymore, but used to be extremely mean, okay? She was the type of person that would give you a $1 million response for a 50-cent comment. So she'd walk down the stairs in the morning, I'd be like, your hair looks really weird. And she'd look me in the eye and go, you should have never been born. I mean it. Mom and Dad should have stopped at one. You shouldn't be here. I'm like, I'm older than you. You wouldn't be here either. I said what I said. You think math is hard? Try doing it while you're questioning your existence. I'm like, I can't solve for X. I don't know why I'm here. Anyway, but at the end of all of that, I thought, I am done with the cold. I'm done with the corn. I'm gonna graduate and I'm gonna move someplace warm for college. I'm gonna go to some tropical place on a beach somewhere and study, you know, out in the sun. So I packed up my stuff and I moved to Indiana. My mom didn't teach us geometry. There it is. Okay. That one always takes a minute, all right? Yeah, and y'all went to public school. Woo! Anyway, but 6 years of college later, I brought my bachelor's degree down here to Atlanta. Happy to be with you today. Some of you missed that one as well. Oh, well. But, sorry. I'm blanking a little bit. Chip, can you put up my message checklist? Introduce yourself. Check that. Make everybody laugh. I think we all agree. Check that one. Convince everybody you blanked. Did you think I got lost just now? Check that one. Prove God exists, magic trick intermission. Okay, prove God exists, easy. 10 years ago, I look like this. Not bad, hair's a little meh. But I was driving this. Now, here's the deal. This is a combination that good parents tell their kids to stay away from. Am I right? I can admit it now, that was a long time ago. But while driving this, I met this girl, okay? Oh, yes, we are married now. So, if this guy plus this van can equal this girl, the only answer is... Thank you. See y'all next week. I'm kidding, but no, my wife is here with me today. We've been married for about 8 years now, which is crazy. But last week we were snowed out, so that wasn't when Samer was here. But the week before that, Samer was here, and he gave an amazing message on pride. It was so good that I began to think about his talk in the days after and the weeks after, and it began to work on me. And I began to really dive into this idea of pride and kind of try to examine where in my life it was hiding and kind of the effects it was having. But he had this line in his talk that I loved and I want to talk a little bit about today. He said this, pride keeps us from a growing faith. And so as I began to think about that in preparation for today, I began to have the question of, well, how does pride keep us from a growing faith? Well, how does that work? How does pride lurk in our life and hide in our life that keeps our faith from growing? And so we're going to look at that, but we're also going to look at how to allow our faith to grow. If it keeps it from growing, how can we actually grow our faith? And so we're going to dive into that today with a story that I am a big fan of. There's a story in the Old Testament about a guy who I really resonate with in a lot of ways. I don't resonate with him in his position or rank that you're going to see, but I resonate with him in some of his responses to some of the things that happened to him. I resonate with him in his emotional disposition and how he interprets things or how he reacts to certain things. And I resonate with him and spiritually too in some of the realizations that we'll come to see. And I hope that throughout this story, you can kind of figure out where in the story you resonate with him too. Because by the end of it, our hope is to all be on the same page about understanding how pride keeps us from a growing faith and how to allow our faith to grow. So without further ado, we're going to jump to 2 Kings chapter 5. It says, now Naaman is the main character, was the commander of the army of the king of Aram. He was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded. Now, Naaman was the commander of all the army of Aram, okay? And there's a king there who highly regarded Naaman. Naaman would have been second in command of the entire kingdom. And so he and the king would have had a very close relationship. But let me tell you why I think the king highly regarded Naaman. Because anytime there's a person in your life who brings you a lot of money, brings you a lot of respect, brings you a lot of prosperity, more land, more servants, more credibility. Anytime there's somebody who serves you in that way, you are gonna highly regard them. You are gonna wanna keep that person around you as long as you can. You wanna keep that person active as long as you can because they are a very valuable asset. So Naaman was a commander of all the army, and the king would tell him to go places and conquer places, and he would, and he would bring back more wealth and more good things for him and the king. It goes on, because through him, the Lord had given victory to Aram. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. So here you have this mighty commander of this army that he only reported to one person. And he would go out and they would fight these battles and they would win and they would bring back all of this wealth and they would celebrate back home. And the king would probably say, this is Naaman. He is our greatest, our most valiant warrior. But amongst all the celebration, somewhere in the back of Naaman's mind, in the back of Naaman's life, there was this low-level hum of disappointment, of struggle that was kind of stealing and depleting the joy and the peace that he would hope to carry with him. We know this low-level hum, don't we? It's the low-level hum of financial crisis when it's coming up, or relational stress with someone you're dating or even in your marriage or a coworker. It's that job that we know we gotta leave and now it's creating us a lot of stress because we're scared to leave it, but we know we need to. It's the person that you haven't forgiven and now that's all you think about is what they did to you, or the person who needs to forgive you and you're just wondering when they're gonna call. And that low-level hum that we carry in our life steals joy from all of our best moments. Maybe you've been to the birthday party where everybody's celebrating and it's supposed to be fun and you're supposed to be excited, but all you're thinking about is how you're gonna word the email when the party's over. How you're gonna resolve the issue when it's done, when you can get back to your phone and see if they've called. And it's that low-level hum that begins to steal our joy and our peace and our freedom. For Naaman, it was not so low or little, it was leprosy, which was a big deal at that time because it's not something they could walk around and just cure. And so Naaman would have thought about this every single day, and he would have allowed it to probably steal the joy from most of the best moments of his life. But they returned from Israel after they were there and they defeated Israel. And with them, they brought some servants back from Israel, one of which was a small girl. She was 10 to 13 years old. And she came back and she served Naaman's wife in their household. And while she was serving Naaman's wife, you can imagine that she would look at Naaman every day and see his leprosy and think, we have got to do something about that. Maybe sunscreen, I'm not sure, but we've got to figure it out. But after enough time went by, she goes to Naaman's wife and she tells him this: if only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy. Really? He could cure my husband of his leprosy. So you imagine Naaman's wife goes to him and he hears this. I don't know what his first reaction would be, but you can imagine, you can resonate with what happens next. That little bit of hope crept in. That little bit of common sense started to spark. That little bit of curiosity started to grow. And you can imagine Naaman thinking about this. What if there really was a cure in Israel? What if this prophet could do what he's saying he could do? What if I didn't have to live this way anymore? What if I could go celebrate and do what everybody else does and have the full experience of joy and peace and excitement? What if I could silence this low-level hum in my life? And so he thinks about it. And eventually he decides, you know what? I'm gonna go to the king and we're gonna talk about this. And here's the king's response: by all means, go. I will send a letter to the king of Israel. Now, if you're the king of Aram, you're like, you mean to tell me this disease that could take you out, could kill you, might have a cure? By all means, go. Because through you, I have found great wealth, great prosperity, lots of respect, lots of credibility. You have gained me so much. So if I can protect my investment, go. In fact, we've already conquered Israel. They're afraid of us. Take this letter from me to this other king, as if to say, it would be in your best interest to heal my first in command, Naaman. So Naaman's got his letter and he starts his journey. So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. Now, as I studied this and looked this up, this would have probably been more wealth than was in all of Israel at the time. And so Naaman is coming with this letter from the king and with all of this money, with all of this wealth, as a desperate man for a cure. And he makes his way all the way to Israel. And there's something interesting that he does. He goes straight to the king of Israel. Now, the little girl, if you remember, told him to go see who? To go see the prophet. She said, there's a prophet in Israel, but Naaman goes straight to the king. This tells us something significant about him. This tells us that Naaman understood the culture enough to know that prophets worked for kings. That in most cultures, most societies, the prophet would have been on the king's payroll. And the king would have kind of paid the prophet to do his bidding a little bit to sway the people one way or the other. This was not the case in Israel, but Naaman doesn't know that yet. And so what Naaman is doing is he is going to the top. He's saying if there's a cure, the king will be the guy who can make it happen. We share this too, this same desire inside of us. If we get sick, we want the top physician. We want the top surgeon, the world renowned. If we get in financial crisis, we want the best financial advisor we can find. We'll ask, we'll do our research, we'll find the best person for our scenario, and we will go straight to them. Naaman is doing the exact same thing, although he's been told to go to a prophet. And so he shows up with this king and he hands him the letter, and the king reads the letter and here's his response. As soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes and said, am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of his leprosy? See how he is trying to pick a quarrel with me. So he does this weird thing where he tears his robe, which is like the Old Testament version of throwing your phone across the room. I'm sure Naaman's like, I brought extra clothes if you need another one. Just throw this on. Here's some khakis too. So the king reads this letter. And his first reaction, his first instinct is like, whoa, wait a minute. I can't cure this man of his leprosy. What are you trying to do? And then he begins to think. He thinks, well, what they're trying to do is they're trying to pick a fight with us. Now I'm gonna have to send this guy home and say, sorry, I couldn't cure him. And now I've just given the king that already defeated us reason to come back and take more livestock and more people and more wealth and destroy us once again. And so the king is in a tough spot, doesn't know what to do. And it's in this moment that he gets word from Elisha, the prophet that the girl was talking about. And Elisha sends word and says, hey, have Naaman come to my house. And I bet the king is like, absolutely I will. And so they send word. And Naaman knows he's supposed to go to Elisha's house. So Naaman went with his horses and chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house. Now, Elisha's house would have been a town that wasn't far from the king of Israel. But picture this. As Naaman is riding into town, all the people in this small town look up and they see the commander of the army that has already once defeated them. And he's in a chariot with a bunch of soldiers. What do you think those people are gonna do? They're gonna flee and they're gonna hide and they're gonna get as far away from there as they can. So I picture Naaman riding into this town that looks completely abandoned, thinking, really? This is where my cure comes from? And finally, he gets to Elisha's house. I bet he gets out of the chariot thinking, okay, there have been a lot of hoops to jump through. This isn't how I expected it to go, but here we go. We're finally gonna get the cure. But Elisha sent a messenger to say to him, go, wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan and your flesh will be restored and you will be cleansed. So Naaman probably stood there much like you and I would. You know, you pay the premium to have the best doctor in the world come and give you a diagnosis and you get a messenger who comes to the door and tells you to do some ridiculous thing. So Naaman's standing there looking at this messenger saying, you mean to tell me you're not Elisha? And I gotta go do what? And I'm sure in that moment he responded like many of us would. In fact, here's how he responded. But Naaman went away angry and said, I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the spot and cure me of leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed? So he turned and went off in rage. Naaman looks at this messenger and goes, wait a minute. I'm not gonna go wash in a river of land that I've already conquered. I'm better than that. I'm surely not gonna go do it 7 times and make a mockery of myself while all of your citizens look at the man who defeated them and now he's having to submit in your dirty waters. No, if it was about washing, I could go back home where the waters are clean and I could do it respectably and then I'd be washed. Have me go there. It's like, have your God conjure up a spell or whatever, fix me, but no, that ain't gonna work. And he leaves in rage. Many of us don't make it past this point of the story in our own lives. We huff and puff our way out of counseling because we just don't think that that's what we need. We rant and we rave away from our next AA meeting because we feel like we're better than the other people that are in that meeting. I don't have the problems they have. We put our problems on other people and we kind of project it onto them and say, no, that's not me. That's not who I am. We deny it even exists. And we sit there in our anger and we never explore the opportunity of obedience that God opens up through us, even if it's through a messenger. But Naaman had something that hopefully you have in your life. Naaman's servants, do you have a servant? Just kidding. Naaman's servants went to him and said, my father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? And here's why they ask him that. It's because they know that Naaman would have done some great thing because they're standing on ground that was a sign of a great thing that Naaman had done. The king had told Naaman to go conquer Israel. He went and he conquered Israel. If the king said, hey, I want you to go conquer this town, he would go conquer it. And that was the transaction between Naaman and the king. That I will go do what you ask me to, and in return, I want wealth, and I want fame, and I want rank, and I want success. And so it should work the same way with your God, Elisha, that I come to you, and I need something from your God, so he requires something from me, and then we have an equal exchange, and now I've earned it, and now I've got this thing because I've done some great thing. And so they know the answer to the question, but they follow it up. How much more then when he tells you, just wash and be cleansed? Now here you have servants, people that are walking around with Naaman with no permission, no authority, no respect, no power, no right to whisper something logical, something sensible, something clear in his ear. They could have been killed for this, but they do. And they say, hey, you're waiting for him to do some big, huge thing. It kind of makes sense that all you got to do is just go wash in that river. So maybe go do it. I wonder who is that person in your life with no permission, no authority, no power, but is whispering those things in your ear. Maybe it's your kids. Dad, I wish you wouldn't drink so much. Mom, can you put your phone down for a second? Hey, friend, I really think you need to get out of that relationship. Hey, coworker, this isn't the job for you. It's destroying you. And hopefully, we can imitate Naaman in this, the fact that he listened. So he went down. Now, this is my favorite part of the story. Naaman is down at the river. He's at the Jordan River. This dirty, murky water of land that he's already conquered. He's already proven he's better than in his mind. And he's standing at the water. And he's thinking, okay, God is asking me to step in this water. God is requiring me to step in this water, and then I will be cleansed of this thing that I've carried my whole life. And while it makes sense to us, looking from the outside, looking in, to Naaman, he's playing his resume over in his head. I've conquered that land and that land and this land and that land. I've slayed so many. I'm worth so much. People respect me. What am I doing? And Naaman is standing there with his obedience being obstructed. So here's my question for you. What is obstructing your obedience? Is it your pride? Is your pride getting in the way of your ability to obey God? Every time somebody suggests something or you feel that thing inside of you that you feel like you know you should do, but your pride kind of keeps it at arm's distance and says, no, not yet. We still are in control of this. We can handle it. Is it unfairness? That person that you know you ought to forgive, but it is really so incredibly unfair that you just offer them up a free forgiveness without them having to earn it or realize how badly they need it. Is it denial? There's nothing wrong. I'm in control. I can figure it out. I'll get to it later. Is it fear? God, I can't do this because I don't know what it looks like on the other side. I can't walk out that door and go find a new job because I don't know what that will look like. What is obstructing your obedience? For Naaman, it was a lot of success and a lot of pride, a lot of sensibility. It does not make sense now medically or then to get in water 7 times to be cleansed of an awful disease. But Naaman went down and dipped himself in the Jordan 7 times as the man of God had told him, and his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy. Now, I imagine Naaman came out of the water and looked at his skin, and more than realizing that he'd been cleansed, probably had a moment that he said, it had nothing to do with the water. And I feel like I'm a lot like Naaman. I feel like the first 6 times that I would have to dunk in the river would be for me to realize it has nothing to do with the water. It has everything to do with the God who's trying to break through to my heart. And on the 7th time when he comes up, he gets it. And the rest of his life is forever changed. As you read the rest of the narrative, he no longer responds to things the same way or acts as things the same way. It's like the whole economy inside of his head has been completely changed. He realized this truth: your trust cannot be bought, borrowed, or bartered. Naaman showed up with all the wealth in the world to buy his cure. And when he left, he realized, man, something more significant happened in there. Something happened with the trust of my life, and I couldn't buy it, I couldn't borrow it, and I couldn't barter for it. I had to build it. And when Naaman realized this, his life was forever changed. And when you realize this, your life begins to change. Because while it is hard to give God your time and your money and your energy and your schedule, the hardest thing to give God is in. Giving in to the thing he's asking you to do. Giving in to, the way I like to say it, is giving in to a yes. Being able to say, God, I'm saying yes to the thing you're asking me to do. I'm saying yes to where you're asking me to step out in faith and obey you. But it's when we're able to say yes time and time again to God that we begin to build something significant. You see, it's really easy, like Naaman said, to wait for and hope for some great thing. This is really difficult. In fact, it's often easier to say yes to a God that expects you to slay a dragon than a God who asks you to step in a river. It's a lot easier to be on board with a God who you're like, you're right, God, I need to be sober. It's really hard to go sign up for the meeting. You know, it's really easy to say yes to a God that you're like, yeah, God, I think you want me to have a better marriage. That's big and it's nebulous and it's vague. It's really hard to say yes to a God that says, sign up for counseling tomorrow. It's really easy to say yes to a God of like, God, I know I should be in healthy relationships that are moving me forward. It's really hard to say, yeah, I'll break up with him. The yeses are extremely difficult, but so significant. So I wonder if you today are in this spot and know what your yes looks like. Maybe for you, you're saying yes to the very thing I've been talking about, signing up for the AA meeting after church is over and saying, you know what? I don't see the problem yet, but people have been talking, so I'm gonna sign up for it. I'm gonna say yes to that. Maybe your yes, sorry, I got a little lost in my yeses here. There we go. Maybe your yes is to break up with that person. The longer you go in the relationship, the farther you feel like you're getting from you, and the more you're becoming somebody you don't understand or know or trust. Maybe your yes is getting home at the time you promise your kids you're gonna get home every day so that you can build the family that you had always hoped you have, not default to the one that you're currently in. Maybe your yes is that, you know, sometime today, this week, you're gonna pick up the phone and you're gonna apologize to that person for what you said about him, for what you did. Maybe you're on the other end of that and you need to pick up the phone and you need to forgive that person for what they did or what they said, even though it feels completely unfair. Maybe your yes is to come out of hiding and let people see what has been unseen for the longest time. Maybe your yes is to be more honest in the workplace, in the financial transactions that you make, in the people that you work with. Or maybe your yes is to put your trust in Jesus because you never have. And you want him to live in your life and kind of help you navigate the difficulties and complexities that life is. Maybe you've never said yes to Jesus. Maybe today that's the yes that he's asking you to say yes to. Maybe that's the step for you today. I'm nervous to do this, watch out. There we go. Your trust cannot be bought, cannot be borrowed, cannot be bartered. It has to be built. Now here's the deal. These individual circumstances, these individual acts of obedience may not immediately impact your circumstances, but what they will do is they will begin to shift your trust. And if you can shift your trust, your life will change. Naaman was in the water and he came out of the water and he was clean. And he said, oh, this was not about a skin cleansing. This was about a trust shifting. This was not about me getting my skin cleaned up or my disease taken away. This was about God shifting my trust from me to him. And while everybody looked at him and said, hey, your skin is clean, your skin is clean, he would have looked back and said, yeah, but my life has changed. And I think oftentimes we get caught up in the skin cleansing part of obedience. And what God is asking us to see today is that when you have your individual yeses, your individual isolated acts of obedience, they are building a trust in Jesus. And over time, your trust shifts from you to him. There was this pattern I saw when studying through Naaman's life that I think applies to us in a lot of ways. And it was this: humility, repetition, and results. When Naaman is going to be cured, what God calls him to is humility. I want you to go get in this river of the land you conquered that you're better than. You remember that. I want you to get in it 7 times, in and out, dry off, suds up, lather, the whole thing. I want you in and out of there. It would have been very humiliating. Oftentimes, the yeses that we just talked about, when I said those to you guys and you were listening, even if they didn't apply to you, you can imagine how humiliating each of them would be. See, this is where pride doesn't work, because God asks us for humility and then repetition. I want you to get in and out of that river 7 times, because it's gonna take you 6 to realize it's not about the water, it's about your trust. And the same is true with us. Every yes that we stack up, every yes that we pile up in obedience is building our trust in Jesus. And lastly, the results. For him, he was cleared of leprosy, but he was also changed in his trust. For you, maybe these acts of obedience will change your marriage. Maybe they will change your life or your parenting or your workplace. But what they will always most certainly do is they will shift your trust from you to the one who made you. And if you're not aware of the things that are coming after your trust or your obedience, I need to make you aware. Because if your pride never allows you to be obedient, your faith will never grow. At the beginning, I said that Samer taught us pride keeps your faith from growing. This is how. If your pride doesn't allow you to be obedient to God, your faith cannot grow. If your pride brings its head up and says, hey, no, that's not us, that's them, that's a them problem, you don't need that, or you get angry, or your pride wins over, and it keeps you from being obedient, you cannot grow your faith. Naaman's life was a perfect example. When he broke through the things that was obstructing his obedience, his trust shifted and his life was forever changed. So here's my question. What's your next step? What riverbank are you standing on? What river do you need to dunk in 6 times to go, it's not about the water. It's not just about the counseling appointments. It's not just about the therapy. God is wanting to shift my trust from me to him. What is your next step? For me, it was about 11 years ago. I was talking to one of a guy who was one of my friends, but he wasn't one of my closer friends. But I was talking to him about my closer friends. And I said, you know, I just don't feel like I have that group of people that you have that really know me and we're super close and all that. And he said, well, yeah, that's because you're the weak link of all your relationships. Which I was like, ouch. But what he explained was I was very selfish relationally. That when I was in a relationship, it would be to gain something for myself. And at first I was like, man, thank you for your honesty. You know the thing we all say to make ourselves look more mature than we actually are? Thank you so much. That's really helpful. And then we go away like, idiot. But I thought about it and I thought, you know what? A lot of my friends were going to see this counselor they were raving about. So I thought, I'll go. So I showed up, the counselor canceled from the parking lot. Hey, I'm sick, traffic, cough, whatever, click. So I didn't go the first time. The second time I showed up and I asked him more questions than he asked me. And that was my intention. I'm gonna out-question the counselor so he can never break through and get to me, you know? So I literally, I'm not kidding, I literally went through the alphabet in my head and thought of a question that started with A. And while he was answering it, thought of a question that started with B and went through the whole alphabet as far as I could go. But on the third time, I let my guard down just enough that he was able to break through. And it wasn't what he said, and it wasn't anything special about the appointment. There was this shift in me where I had this understanding now of why people go to counseling, of why I needed to go to counseling. And it was this. To me, it was this picture of driving in a car. And you know how every car has blind spots. And your rearview mirrors, your past experiences, your wisdom, all of that can only see so much. And you need somebody in the passenger seat to look back and say, hey, it's clear, you can merge. Or hey, careful, you're gonna crash into that. And for me, it became so clear that my yeses of, hey, I'm gonna show up and only make it to the parking lot, to I'm gonna show up and not let him talk, to I'm gonna show up and let him say a little bit, led me to an understanding that was crucial to the health of my relationships every day thereafter. And I can't imagine what would have happened had I not said yes in the beginning. So What's your next step? And are you willing to say yes? Are you willing to put on some humility, show some repetition, and enjoy the results of a loving God shifting your trust from you to him? Heavenly Father, thank you so much for loving us enough to guide us in obedience. God, thank you that you are a God who is trustworthy, that I can stand up here and confidently say that if you trust God, he will never let you down. God, shift our trust this week through our obedience. I pray that everybody in this room, whether it be through a friend, a child, a spouse, or on their own ability, God, I pray that everybody would have made clear to them a step to take and the courage and the confidence to say yes to that step. God, I am excited as you begin to shift trust in people all throughout this community. We love you so much. We thank you for your kindness, your goodness, and your love, and the strength that you give us. It's in your name we pray. Amen.